Okay, we have everybody here. Okay, thank you. Please be seated, and we'll go ahead and proceed with our first case today. And so I'll call case number 58711, Reimer versus the State of Nevada. We have Ms. Lampke representing the appellant, Mr. Stanton representing the respondent, Mr. DiGiacomo is here as well on behalf of the respondent. We have set this case for a 60-minute argument because of the numerous issues raised by the parties to give you an adequate time to present your arguments to the court. Ms. Lampke, do you wish to reserve any time in rebuttal after 30 minutes?
Yes, sir. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes.
Okay, you may do so. And just for the record, you'll see there are five justices here in court. Justices Hardesty and Sada are not here, but they will be participating in the decision of this case, and they will be listening to this tape of this oral argument then at the conclusion. So with that, you may proceed, Ms. Lincoln.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If I may it please the court, counsel. In Smith v. State, this court held that in order to be guilty of child endangerment, a defendant, and I'm quoting here, must know or have reason to know of abuse or neglect, yet permit or allow the child to be subject to it. This requirement, as the court said, of knowledge and reasonableness adequately defines the state of mind required for a finding of guilt and effectively precludes punishment for inadvertent or ignorant acts. That is precisely what we have here before Your Honors today. By virtue of the prosecution's failure to plead and prove this critical element, that is that knowledge requirement, we have convictions that punish precisely what the Smith court was concerned about, ignorant and inadvertent acts. I would ask Your Honors to turn first to the child endangerment conviction, because this is the charge out of which everything kind of proliferates with respect to the death of young Jason in this particular case. And what we have here is we have the child endangerment charge that's based on NRS 200.508, subsection 2. Now, NRS 200.508 has two subsections. There's 1 and 2, and for ease of reference, I'm going to refer to 1 as the active part of the statute. And that sub 1 actually says in order to be guilty of a crime that is child abuse, you have to actively do something. You have to either abuse the child yourself, or you have to permit the child to be abused. Sub 2, which is what they charged in this particular case, in both the felony murder charge and the child endangerment charge relating to Jason's death, is what I would refer to as the passive component of the statute, that is the child endangerment part of the statute. And it says, and I'm quoting from the statute, a person who is responsible for the safety and welfare of a child, who permits or allows that child to suffer physical pain or mental suffering as a result of abuse or neglect, or to be placed into a situation where the child may suffer pain or mental injury, is guilty of child endangerment. The statute then goes on to define the term allow to mean that if you allow this to happen, it means that you do nothing to prevent the abuse or neglect in circumstances, and this is critical language here, in circumstances where the person knows or has reason to know that the child is being abused. The statute also defines permit, because again, in this passive part of the statute, you can allow or permit. In this language, I know it seems kind of like minutia, but it's critical. You can allow or permit in order to be guilty of the passive child endangerment. And permit is defined as permission that a reasonable person would not grant, which amounts to neglect of responsibility attending to the care of a child. Now, when this issue came before the Supreme Court in Smith v. State, and in that case, it was very factually similar. You have a non-offending parent who was charged with allowing an offending parent to do something that resulted in abuse to a child. And that non-offending parent, Smith, challenged this statute, 200.508, on a vagueness challenge. And what this court did was, this court said, we're going to uphold the statute against the vagueness challenge, but only because we read this language, that is the definition of allow and the definition of permit, to reread this to mean that in order to be guilty under this passive component of the statute, that is the endangerment component, where you allow someone else to do something that results in harm to your child, you have to know or have reason to suspect, reason to know, that that harm might happen. In this particular case, we didn't have that. In fact, the prosecutors didn't even allege it. In the charging document itself, and again, this child endangerment charge is critical because it is the basis upon which you have the murder charge that they alleged, and ultimately it is the basis upon which, at least one of the possible bases, upon which the jury found Mr. Reimer guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Listen to the language of the charging document on this child endangerment charge. It's very lengthy. It's very difficult to apprehend. But conspicuously absent from this language is anything in which the prosecutors allege that Mr. Reimer knew or had reason to know that his child would be in danger if left in the care of his wife. That child endangerment charge reads, and I'm going to only read the salient parts because it's exceedingly long. Defendant did, being responsible for the safety and welfare of Jason, care of a child under 18 years old, Jason Reimer, being approximately 4 years old, to suffer unjustifiable physical pain and substantial bodily harm by permitting Jason to be placed in a situation where he suffered unjustifiable physical pain and substantial bodily harm, the defendant's being responsible for the care and supervision under safety of Jason, Jason having special needs, defendants permitted or allowed Jason to suffer unjustifiable physical pain or mental suffering as a result of neglect or endangerment, defendants did fail to supervise or care for Jason by failing to know or ascertain the whereabouts and the circumstances of Jason, who had been left unattended in a motor vehicle by Colleen, the mother, the co-defendant in this case.
Ms. Lemke, is your position that this special needs child that by all accounts was unable to fend for itself, the parent, the father, the co-parent, has no responsibility, no liability whatsoever, can go just in a corner and say, I know nothing, and therefore I'm not responsible? Is that your argument, basically?
Well, Your Honor raises a really good point. What I'm saying here is that to the extent that a parent relies on another caretaker, and this is a caretaker that they have no reason to suspect is going to be negligent in their care of that child.
Don't you, as a parent with equal responsibility, have some obligation?
Some obligation to do...
What was it, 17 hours?
Well,
did not see, look for, ask about the child?
Well, keeping in mind that, number one, Mr. Reimer was ill. Number two, a good person...
Was that substantiated at the trial?
Well,
he was ill. I saw that, but I understand there's no corroboration of him actually being ill.
Well, what we know is that he went to church on Sunday. We know from the testimony of his fellow churchgoers, many of whom saw him on a regular basis on Sundays, that this was one of the only Sundays where he actually left church and went home. The undisputed testimony from the people in the home, once they returned home, was such that he had gone up to his room because he wasn't feeling well, and that's where he stayed all day. Now, was there a doctor who actually came in and said, yes, I diagnosed him with the flu or some other virus or malady that caused him to remain in his bed that whole day? No, there wasn't. But the point is this, is that he left and he went up to his room because he wasn't feeling well. That was undisputed at trial. And he left his children to the care of his wife, an individual with whom he had no reason to suspect would be negligent in her care of those children. And that's why I make such a big deal in my opening remarks about this knowledge requirement, because this is critical. And this court realized that this knowledge requirement was critical.
But I'm saying, is it reasonable to allow him to totally absolve himself of all responsibility for care, custody, and control of his child when he is there physically, and no one said he was incapacitated during any of that period of time? And additionally, it's alleged that for the majority of the time, the wife is in the room with them. So isn't it a reasonable parent would inquire about their special needs child somewhat?
I think really, I understand the point that Your Honor is making, but I think ultimately what you get down to, the question that you have to answer is this. Is a parent entitled to reasonably rely upon another caretaker, be it a spouse, partner, mother, sister, brother, whatever, to care for a child?
Well, I guess the reasonable question is that parent reasonably responsible? You are attempting to shift it someplace else, but they are two parents. They are co-parents. This one is not off-site, they're on-site. I don't remember any agreement that I would exclusively take control and this, that, and the other. We have various things in the record about the other children doing things for the minor child and so on, but this special situation about this person not doing anything, not inquiring about his child.
Well, and that question begs the following response, Your Honor. We would have to tell...
Additionally, we are at the point where the charge, or what he was convicted of, was a manslaughter count, not the higher count, so the jury did see some difference.
Well, and I'm going to get to that in a minute, because this child endangerment is the kind of the broken foundation upon which all of this derives, ultimately. Because what happens is that in your, to answer Your Honor's question about is he absolved of responsibility, what he is able to do, what the law allows a parent to do, is to rely on another parent to take care of a child. Now I understand that you're saying that he did not make inquiry, but think about it. This is where that knowledge...
Allow you, but does it absolve you?
Well, and I understand what Your Honor's saying, but the problem is that in order for your hypothetical to kind of come into play, you know, where a parent's allowed to just, you know, unfettered let a child just, you know, wander indefinitely for hours on end on his own, particularly a special needs child or someone that's the functional equivalent of age two, as we have in this particular case. The question is, does that parent know or have reason to know that the child is going to be in harm's way if that child is being watched by another caretaker? That's ultimately what the question in this case comes down to, because Steen wasn't the only one in that house, and the undisputed facts were that Colleen was caring for the child. She's the one who brings the child home from church. She's the one who has the child in the car. She is the one who gets out of the car. And there is no evidence to suggest that at any time Stan was not within his right to rely on her as a caretaker. And that's why it's so critical when you get back to this idea of him having to know or have reason to know, a fact upon which the jury was never instructed. And it wasn't even pled. In the charge. And I would ask you, in keeping with your question, because I do think it's a very important one, Your Honor, contrast the manner in which this case was pled. And I read it. I understand it's convoluted. It was exceedingly difficult for even me to understand, not to say that I'm exceedingly brave either. But now contrast that language. Okay, well, it's very convoluted. You have responsible and welfare and, you know, did they find him? Did they not? He was left in the car by Colleen. Now contrast that to the very simple and easy to understand language that the prosecution utilized in Smith, where, again, factually almost identical situation, although it wasn't a negligent act that caused the death, it was actually an intentionally abusive act. But in that case, the way they charged it, and wisely so, was that the defendant, again, the non-offending parent, did willfully, unlawfully, feloniously, knowingly, being a person responsible for the safety and welfare of the child, so now we know we're in the endangerment, that is the passive part of NRS 200-508, did willfully, unlawfully, and feloniously, being a person responsible for the safety and welfare of a child, allow Andy, was his name, to be placed in a situation where he suffered unjustifiable physical pain and bodily harm, to wit, and then listen to this, by having knowledge that her child, Glenn Anderson Elam, was being physically abused by her live-in boyfriend. Excuse me. Again, the pleading in that case, unlike the pleading here, alleged that knowledge requirement, such that in that case, when the mother left the child with the abusive partner, I think it was actually her boyfriend, there was an allegation that she knew or had reason to know that leaving the child with that partner was going to be a problem. And they didn't plead that in this particular case. The jury never got the opportunity to say, look, we have to evaluate this child endangerment charge with this element.
Ms. Lipke, are you saying that he never knew of anything that was going on in the household, from the dirty carpets to the lice in the hair of the children to the other things that were alleged? That he never knew any of this? He was just removed because he'd given the duty of raising the kids to the mother? Is that your argument?
No, because...
What is the argument?
No, because the child endangerment charge is the first charge, and that has to do with, or it's the second actually, that has to do with the offense pertaining to Jason's death. The child abuse and neglect charges, counts 3 through 7, those are under the active part of the statute. That is 200-508(1). That's a totally different part of the statute, and that deals with you directly either abusing or permitting the child to be in danger. That doesn't necessarily have to do with this particular endangerment part of the statute, which is sub 1. And that's the charge that they charged Sam with pertaining to Jason's death, and that is the felony accusation that they included in that second-degree murder charge as well. So that's why I say I start my argument with that, because that's critical. And again, that knowledge requirement is critical, because in this case, that was the whole issue. You know, can a parent, I mean, I would pose the question back to Your Honor, is it okay for a parent to rely on another, on their spouse in taking care of a child, as long as they don't have reason to believe that that spouse or caretaker is going to be deficient in their abilities to care for the child? The undisputed testimony was that that child was in Colleen's custody when he came home from church. So the question ultimately became, did Stan know or have reason to know that there was going to be a problem, such that he then had that duty, as Your Honor suggested, to go out and look for the child? And the problem is that the jury was never informed that they have to make a finding on that no or reason to know element. And that was critical. In fact, that is the one reason that this court, when another litigant in Smith challenged that statute for vagueness, saying, look, you cannot make a non-offending parent liable for everything that an offending parent does unless they know or have reason to know that there's a problem.
The defense make this argument in their clothes?
I'm sorry?
The defense make the argument that you're making now in their closing argument.
Well, the problem was is the defense asked for a jury instruction that delineated that knowledge requirement, and the judge refused it. So the problem was...
But did they make the argument? Okay, they refused. Did they make the argument, though?
I mean, my recollection, and again, we're talking of thousands of pages of lower court records, so forgive me, Your Honor.
I understand, but you know the record better than I do, so I'll ask the question to you.
Yeah, I mean, he tried to make the argument, I think, as best that he could. But the problem is that you are, without a jury instruction, actually delineating that element. There's not the foundation upon which he can actually say, look, this is a material element of this charge, and if they have failed to prove this element beyond a reasonable doubt, you must acquit Mr. Reimer. And so even if he was able to make that argument in some form or fashion, because that was their entire theory of the case, right, was that ultimately there's nothing in the law that prohibits a spouse from entrusting their child to the care of another spouse, particularly when they're ill. And I would, you know, ask Your Honors to reflect upon times when, you know, you have been ill and incapacitated and, you know, relied on someone else to care for your children. There's nothing in the law that prohibits that. It becomes criminal if you have reason to suspect that the person that you entrust your child to is going to abuse or neglect your child. And the jury had a right, and Mr. Reimer had a right, to have the jury informed on that material element.
Ms. Lumpke, I know in the interest of time, I have a question.
I apologize. Yeah,
the court does have some interest, I think, in the severance of the counts and the parties, the double jeopardy issue, and the prosecutorial misconduct allegations.
Okay.
So maybe you could... Give us your thoughts on that and anything else you want to bring up.
Okay, if I may, just before I move on, just quickly, because Your Honor posed a really good question. He wasn't convicted of the second-degree murder, so why is the child endangerment conviction ultimately a big deal? I'll tell you why. Because he was convicted of involuntary manslaughter, and one of the predicate findings that the jury must make pursuant to the elements of involuntary manslaughter is that there was a death that occurred during the commission of an unlawful act. Well, here's what happens. When they find that child endangerment charge, and again, Your Honor, keeping in mind, the child endangerment is different from the child abuse counts 3 through 7. When they found that Mr. Reimer was guilty of that child endangerment charge, count 2, then they found that predicate unlawful act in the language of involuntary manslaughter. And that then induces that conviction on that charge as well, because they found that predicate. So I just want to make that point, that with respect to the errant charging, the errant jury instructions, the deficient jury instructions on that knowledge requirement, and the failure to prove any knowledge, that then led to not only conviction on the child endangerment, but the involuntary manslaughter as well, because it then gave them that factual predicate to find that unlawful act that occasioned death. Now, with that, turning to the severance of counts, court's indulgence. Okay, so Nevada law, NRS 174.165, authorizes severance if it appears that the state of the defendant will be prejudiced by the joinder of the offenses. And Your Honor brought up a really good point when you mentioned the child abuse counts, because it's very difficult for jurors to separate out in some ways the conduct that gave rise to counts 1 and 2, which are the counts pertaining to the death of the child, and then counts 3 through 7. And if I may have the court's indulgence with this time, is this, am I into my rebuttal time yet? No, okay. Those counts had nothing to do with one another, yet they were very insidious in terms of the inferences that each, or the implications that each set of offenses had for the other set. This court has said that it's okay to join offenses if you have one single act or transaction, or if you have two or more acts that are connected together. In this particular case, these two sets of incidents, if you will, that is Jason's death and then the abuse and neglect allegations with the filthy home and all this other stuff over the preceding 4 years, that's not the same act or transaction. You've got the allegations of what happened in the years prior, and then you've got the allegations of child endangerment that ultimately led to Jason's death on that one singular day. So they're definitely not the same act or transaction. They're not part of any common scheme or plan. As this court has said, a common scheme or plan does not necessarily connote isolated incidents, however similar they may be. That's Richmond versus State. But it says there has to be an overarching kind of sweeping plan of which both incidents are a part. And clearly here, there was no plan ultimately to occasion Jason's death. There was no, you know, conceived plan to have dirty aquariums or dirty carpets or torn shower curtains or cluttered boxes in the house. There was not some single overarching plan of which Jason's death and the dirty house were all a part. So they weren't part of any common scheme, plan, or single transaction that would allow them to be brought in a single indictment. The problem is they have a very insidious effect in terms of prejudicing the jury on each count, because what you have is you have on counts 1 and 2, which are the counts relating to Jason's death, an allegation that there was neglect that caused his death. Then you've got in counts 3 through 7, all of these allegations about spanking and verbal abuse, which, by the way, Stan, the worst word apparently he used was damn. And you've got boxes, filthy aquariums, foul odors, and some paint containers, things along that line. Well, if you're a jury looking and evaluating whether or not there was negligence that occasioned a child's death, and we can all agree those were the more serious charges here, you're going to look at the other things and say, you know, these are people who have just been blowing it from day one. And that, whether you want to, whether they're instructed accordingly or not, is going to have a really negative effect in terms of how the jurors then perceive whether or not there was an endangerment or a homicide that was committed on that day. Ultimately, those abuse counts, that is 3 through 7 with the neglect allegations, contaminates the manner in which the jury then evaluates the child endangerment charge, and it makes them much more predisposed to believe that there was some criminal negligence that ultimately endangered the life and took the life of this child. Likewise, if you look at these, and I do the converse, if you look at the counts 3 through 7, where they're alleging dirty laundry on the floor and foul odors, and I like to call it felony foul odors, or someone in my office referred to it smelly. If you have those in isolation, those may not necessarily, by perception of a juror adjudicating the offenses, may not be worthy of a felony conviction, child abuse and neglect, but now when evaluated against the backdrop of a child who ultimately died, it prejudices the jury in such a way that it makes them much more likely to convict on those latter counts. So at the end of the day, these charges should have been severed. The trial court erred by not severing the offenses, and the prejudice that Stan suffered as a result was great. He was convicted on nearly everything. The only thing they didn't convict on was the murder, but in lieu of that, they did convict on manslaughter, and he ultimately was sentenced to 30 years in prison for that.
Just in the interest, you had a little over 7 minutes. Did you want to reserve that, or did you want to go on?
Oh, I'm sorry. I do want to reserve that. I apologize, but yes, I do.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Stanton. Yeah.
Thank you, and good morning. I'd like to begin by quoting from the appellant brief at page 78, where it is alleged, and is the core of the argument that you just heard, that the state apparently believed that Mr. Reimer was required, quoting, to make unspecified reconnaissance missions inside this home. The state did no such thing. what the state argued and what the jury found in this case is what the law requires, and it's one word, that Stanley Reimer be a parent. He failed in that in so many different ways, but what is compelling is the argument you just heard where there was a distinction drawn between an offending and non-offending parent, citing to the Smith case. It's the state's theory at trial and before you now that both of these parents were offending parents in the death of Jason, and they were in the following manner. Mrs. Reimer offended the child, and as that term is meant legally, by the conduct of leaving Jason's removal of the car, knowing, as both parents did, that he was physically incapable of removing himself from the vehicle. To Aaron Reimer, who the state called as a witness in this case to show, number one, he couldn't be qualified as a witness. Number two, he was who Colleen relied upon to remove his brother, because she physically was unable to carry it. Because Ms. Reimer, as the record amply reflects, had significant both mental and physical infirmities, which was proved at trial and was imputed as it should be to the knowledge of Stanley Reimer and his obligation. And thus, his offending behavior begins when Ms. Reimer walks into the door, because his obligation is as a parent there in the home. Not in situations where, as counsel says, you know, can you not reasonably rely on another parent to care for a child? Of course you can.
Mr. Stanley, the child that was the delegated caregiver for Jason, how old was he?
I believe he was approximately 16, Your Honor. He was otherwise of age and of physical ability, assuming mentally he would have been able to maybe cognize the severity and the responsibility that was thrust on him that day. And thus, when Ms. Reimer walked in the door, she certainly did have conduct in addition to Stanley Reimer's of the responsibility to care for this child and actual direct knowledge. And the question then, as asked and begged in the appellant brief and argued to you just moments ago, is what is Stanley's obligations? Well, the unqualified or uncontroverted facts of this case were that Mr. Reimer knew that his wife had medical and mental difficulties, that their habit and custom on Sundays was to, as borrowing from the appellant's word, sequester themselves in their room, which was completely different in both structure, cleanliness, and facilities from the rest of the children in the home, and say, I'm sick, I have no obligation.
Let me ask this question. I'm trying to go forward with your thoughts. So, knowing that his wife was infirm mentally and physically, what if he had gone to work? Would you have said, as a district attorney, that he had an obligation to call to check on the special need child?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor.
So, it's the fact that he went upstairs and supposedly was sick or not sick.
Yeah, and to answer the question, Justice Douglas's questions, outside of Stanley's statement to certain family members that he was ill, there was no independent evidence ever presented at the trial that speaks to that. But more importantly, Your Honor, is that it was the uncontroverted testimony that the habit and custom of Jason was to be in his parents' room. And in one of the most compelling aspects of this trial, in essence, the proverbial head of the household caring for all the children, because the eldest child did, both Crystal and Stanley Jr. in their testimony, each absorbed that role because both of the parents had abdicated, not only on that day, but for months leading up to it, if not years.
But it wasn't uncommon for Jason to be downstairs playing with his siblings either.
It wasn't uncommon, Your Honor. I think a fair reading of the testimony was that it wasn't uncommon for him to do that on a regular basis. But the habit and custom on Sunday was that he was with his parents in his room. That was testified to by several of the siblings. So the question then begs itself to it is, you know, at what point are you responsible for a special needs child to then ascertain his whereabouts when he is normally in the home and requires care throughout the day. That, I thought, was a compelling aspect, in fact, that presented to this jury, is that this is not some child that you could, you know, leave alone, presumably, and they would be capable of caring for themselves, either through other children or not. It required specific treatment of this young child, the G-tube that was to facilitate not only eating, but also breathing, and the cleanliness and the insertion area of that. So this case is substantially different from any other situation or assessment of a normal child and the responsibilities of both parents throughout the day to check on his welfare, regardless of whether or not there are other children present of presumable age to care for him, which it was clearly testified before this jury, that it was a family effort to care for one another and to care for Jason. But that does not alleviate the legal burden of what was required of both parents in this particular case. And frankly, they did nothing. And the evidence, and speaking to the severance of the counts of the remaining, I thought that the court had some questions about, was directly relevant for precisely that reason, to show that the evidence of neglect and abuse in this particular case, as it relates to all children and to Jason, was chronic. Not just acute, but was chronic. It was cross-admissible, had it been assessed as the law requires you to do in reviewing this, was there a cross-admissibility? Absolutely. In essence, the defense in this case was it was a tragic accident. And of course, it's not an accident. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't an accident that day, and it hadn't, and probably shocking, I think, to the jury that some calamity such as this, maybe not relying, ending up in a child's death, hadn't happened before. And it was coupled with specific acts. Remember, Quaylen led up to the parents' room, and the only attempt ever, from the facts that were adduced at trial, of anybody attempting to ascertain or save Jason, if he was savable at that time at all, was when Quaylen Reiner tentatively walked up the stairs of that home and knocked on the door. And as he testified to the jury, he was scared to do it. Why? Because he was scared about his reaction of his father. His father, who had berated CPS workers on an absolute regular basis to the point of calling them at their home to harass them, the social workers, calling them at home, intimidating them all in front of the children and other members of the Reiner household. So this young man, who obviously and also relevantly is beaten by the defendant, as the other, as the counts alleged, as well as the abuse and neglect of those children, he's the one that goes up and tentatively asks for help. And this, Mr. Reiner's response, he cracks the door open to the point where Quaylen can't really ascertain by looking in over his father's shoulder whether or not his brother is even in the room. And tentatively, at best, he makes some inquiry, knowing that he's concerned about his own safety and well-being, that if he asks in his mind a stupid question, he's going to pay the price. Once again, the responsibility highlighted to the defendant is, the quotation here is, the non-offending parent. And that's not the state's theory, both in the instructions under the law then and now, and under the facts presented to this jury. They were both offending parents. As far as the severance of counts, or the severance of the defendants, I read recently a law review article about out of the Ninth Circuit, assessment of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, about how frequently appellate courts use terms in severance and the defenses used imprecisely. And this court has very helpfully used those terms with precision, and that in this particular case we can unequivocally assess that the defenses in this case were, number one, not mutually exclusive, which is the fundamental test on the issue of severance of defendants, which in and of itself is not a basis to sever, but didn't even exist in this case. And as in the Marshall decision, these cases, I would submit, aren't even mutually antagonistic. There is simply kind of a common thread through both of them, that they didn't know that there was going on. They were relying on other people, and it certainly wasn't in a conflicting defense at all. This is the other aspect of the severance decision, at least in the Chartier case, was a specific denial of a trial right. And simply in the appellate brief or the reply, that is never argued that that exists in this case. And I would submit it's not argued because it doesn't exist. They cannot articulate the denial of a specific trial right that existed in this case. The other aspect of the severance motion is the attempt to admit or seek admission of Coley Reimer's statement. This statement, Your Honors, was the one where in an interview, the interview took place sometime after the discovery of Jason's body. The interview was a joint investigation between an abuse neglect investigator, not a detective, by the name of Salchak. And the homicide detective was Bob Rogers. Bob Rogers was the one that testified at trial. And there came a point where Stanley Reimer's defense team sought to admit a statement by Colleen Reimer about that she was solely responsible for Jason. And the argument at trial, and to some extent on appeal, although I would submit it somewhat convoluted, is that what was she admitting to? Was she admitting to responsibility, sole responsibility of taking Jason out of the car, or as the defense is now suggesting, that she was taking sole responsibility to the acts or the criminal acts that applied to Jason? The testimony properly by the presiding district court, I believe, was that it was the Detective Rogers' testimony that his belief of the context of the interview was that she was speaking about responsibility to take the child out of the car, which was, I think, largely uncontroverted at trial. She was the parent that drove Jason home from church, and that Stanley Reimer was inside the home at that point. And he was permitted to testify properly about his impression about that statement. What is improper, and thus not even a basis for a severance of the defendants, is that that statement, assuming that it was accepting responsibility in total, would have been inadmissible under several different bases had the defendants been severed to begin with. And the most compelling of that is the sole province of the jury to make that determination about responsibility of activity such as this, and not a grieving mother whose child she just found several hours or minutes before deceased in their car. And thus, severance, I would submit, it was properly ruled on and not an abuse of discretion by the trial court. There was the issue about trial counsel. I would just submit that briefly on the fact that there was four times this case was continued at the defense request prior to trial, and at the eve of trial, it was clear to the court, based upon the record, that the court perceived that it was Stanley Reimer's attempt to manipulate the court process, and that's in part a basis of the denial. As far as the prosecutorial misconduct, there's only just one aspect I'd like to address. I think the briefs address our response to those. And I know Ms. Lemke was not trial counsel, but the quotation to the state in its argument that the comment, the quote in the appellant's brief, is only a portion, and I would submit taken out of context, about the right to speak after Jason died. And it was argued in the appellant's brief that that is prosecutorial misconduct as a comment on the defendant's right to remain silent. Of course, the next two sentences put that into context, and I think it's very important for the court to understand that the argument went on to say that indeed the right, the silence in this case, was the silence of the children, the Reimer children, that had largely been silent because of the conduct of this particular defendant, Stanley Reimer. In his approach, I would say abusive approach, to the other parties in our communities that tasked to ascertain the safety of children, and that is the Division of Family Services and the Child Protective Services Unit. It is that who Mr. DiGiacomo was referring to in the silence, and that was at the point when Jason's death literally opened the cork to this bottle where the kids now were able to speak unfettered to the police. And that was when all the facts and evidence began to come out. And so there is, I would submit, no basis to claim that prosecutorial misconduct took place, because the reference clearly was the silence of the children. The reference to Mr. Ronner being in jail was an unsolicited statement by Stanley Jr. in a very passionate statement about the communication with his father. The comments about beating the children posed in the questions by myself to several of the children, and the judge sustained those in the sense that the children described them as slaps or punches or whatever the term they was. They did not use the word beat, but obviously the jury was instructed that questions by counsel is not evidence, and to then claim that using the term beat in closing argument was prosecutorial misconduct, I would submit it's not. That's what the state's theory was, and what I think the evidence showed, the distinction between something that is a criminal beating as opposed to a permissible corporal punishment.
Mr. Stanton, did the court tell the state not to use the term beating and use the term spanking instead?
Well, the court didn't instruct the state not to. What the court said was that the child had described it in a term other than beat. And I personally, kind of after that objection and sustaining it, wasn't 100% successful in changing it to spanking or beating or paddling. I think we were talking about the strikes with the oar with the shark's teeth on it that were being administered to the children on numerous occasions and numerous times. So that was the court's admonition, and I believe was to keep it consistent with the term described by the children themselves. And they did not use the term beat. That was my term.
Okay.
Your Honors, I go back to the bulk of the argument at the beginning of this appellate brief and the number of issues there. I think as the court indicated and as the verdicts in this case determined, that the jury acquitted Mr. Reimer of second-degree murder.
And Mr. Stanton, if I can walk you through or have you walk me through NRS 200.070(1), which is involuntary manslaughter.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of those perplexing statutes. It says involuntary manslaughter is the killing of a human being, comma, without any intent to do so, comma, in the commission of an unlawful act, comma, or lawful act, which probably might produce such a consequence in an unlawful manner, comma, but whether involuntary killing occurs in the commission of an unlawful act, comma, which, comma, in its consequence, comma, naturally tends to destroy the life of a human being, comma, or is committed in the prosecution of a felonious intent, comma, the offense is murder. Walk us through that, how it applies in this case.
Well, I would apply it in this fashion, that the responsibility to care for Jason Reimer under the circumstances that he was in, that is of a special needs and in his attendant position, was inherently dangerous in the sense of that the defendant, this particular defendant, had an obligation to check on his welfare on a regular basis while he was at home, and that failure to do so put that child at risk. And whether or not he had been in the automobile, which I believe was his responsibility at the point, as I indicated before, when Colleen and Ronald walked through the front door, that there was no longer a single parent's responsibility, but a joint parent's responsibility to determine that. The distinction I would give, Justice Douglas, is the example of what we see, unfortunately, in our community about children drowning in pools. In this particular case, there is a time period where Jason could have survived and could have been saved. And at what point do you as a parent have an obligation to ascertain the whereabouts of your child under these specific facts and circumstances to determine that he is found and okay, especially in light of the fact that your co-parent is in the same room as yourself, as opposed to in another part of a home. I don't know what they're doing. They're out mowing the lawn. They're out doing something else. But the uncontroverted testimony is that they are in the room together and that the child is not in the room as well. And thus, I would submit that that is the type of conduct that that statute you just read, convoluted as it is, addresses about conduct that would cause death or potentially cause death. Justices, unless there's any other questions of the state on any particular factual matter of the trial record or the issues as briefed, the state has nothing further to...
I think you did a good job on the involuntary manslaughter and the child endangerment. What worries me is the joinder of the other, the child abuse, 3 through 7, that Ms. Lemke brought up. And the reason I bring it up is because of the analytics in Tavish-Murphy, that reversal, where the murder case was reversed against Mr. Bidney, who was the victim, Ms. Murphy and Mr. Tavish, when they had evidence of some beating with some guy with a phone book, whatever. And I just wonder, I almost feel like you bootstrapped the involuntary manslaughter and the child endangerment in counts 1 and 2 by putting all that stuff in about the child abuse and the child and neglect.
I apologize for cutting you off.
All I was going to say is I would have been more comfortable, if you had tried to not charge it, but tried to admit it under Petrocelli, where you could have advance notice to the defense as to exactly what was going to go on, an evidentiary hearing, and then to find that it was clear and convincing that it would be that the probative value would not be outweighed by the prejudice. And so that's where I'm coming from. And
sure.
That's that former defense attorney, you know, once in a while it comes out from me, isn't
right.
It? Jack Monnuts yesterday. But help me out. Tell me why Tavish-Murphy is so different and that would cause a reversal as opposed to this case where there's a joinder of the child abuse and neglect of bad parenting. And I admit, bad parenting, you certainly showed that, but it's I almost feel like you bootstrapped your counts 1 and 2 with the child abuse and neglect.
Sure, I'd be happy to, Your Honor. First of all, in Tavish-Murphy, I think the dissimilarities between those two events were so compelling that they had really no rational relationship to either one. They dealt with different victims, different motives, different intent, different locations, different subject matter as a whole. The only similarity was that the defendants were involved in that enterprise or the same acts are alleged against him, but literally no commonality between either of the events. In this case, as is argued in the brief, one of the critical inquiries about, as Just Douglas indicated, the assessment of the voluntary or the involuntary manslaughter and the child endangerment is the chronic nature of the abuse and neglect. Is this an episodic issue with these parents, or as the evidence related, probative evidence related as to the neglect of the other children, that they're in essence feral caps? These kids are raising themselves. The conduct of the parents in the room isn't an aberration. It's not a Sunday activity. It's every single day. And that conduct, I think, was critical to assess fairly that this responsibility of the parents had just been completely abdicated. It's not a question of dirty homes and poor parenting. It's a question of not parenting at all. That they left the responsibility to usually the oldest child, cycled through with the children because both of the oldest child, Stanley Jr. and Crystal, as soon as they were aged out and schooled out, they left. That was their testimony. And what did they find when they both left? That there was a world out there completely different than the horrors of what happened inside their home, as testified to both of them, about the abuse, both physical and mental, the conditions of the home. As Stanley Jr. testified, he had no idea that life about normal families was different from what they did until he left the home on his mission. And then he goes, there was a huge different world out there. So that's the relevance and the probative nature and the nexus between the two, not to show propensity, but to show at the core of this case as to the first two counts that it's not a mistake of what happened to Jason this day.
If we were to find that it happens to be error on the joinder, could you still make an argument that it's harmless error and that the convictions for child endangerment and involuntary manslaughter should stand?
Certainly, because of what I would submit are the egregious facts in this case. We're talking about a child who's left, a special needs child, who's left alone for 17 hours in a car, no attempt was made by either parent to ascertain the location of this child for any reason during that time period. Whose habit and custom would have been to be in the room or at a minimum required their attendance and presence prior to that child even going to sleep that night, to change him, to bathe him, to make sure that his G-tube was clean, to permit him to breathe and to consume food, which was a necessity that evening after church, none of which was done.
And the only reason I'm making such a big deal out of this is you brought up the thing about drowning, and I, as a district judge, had a drowning case that I granted the writ. This court, before I was on it, affirmed my granting of the writ for the defense.
I think that
there could be a joinder of maybe some child neglect or child abuse stuff, and that would like bootstrap the drowning situation.
I don't think it's bootstrapping, Your Honor, if it speaks to the relevant issue about the nature and circumstances of the child drowning. If the child's drowning, the circumstances of their supervision or lack of supervision is relevant to that, then I don't think it's bootstrapping, because then it gives you the real view picture of how that person as a parent supervises their child, as opposed to saying, look, they're just a bad parent all the time, and therefore they were a bad parent on this day. I think that's the distinction of finding out whether or not this is truly an accident or whether or not this is probably a preordained event.
Okay. Mr. Sand, I have one question on the double jeopardy issue with the convictions here. What's your thoughts on that? Are they separate or is one assumed?
I think it's separate, and thankfully your last decision on double jeopardy, I think, gave us a tremendous amount of guidance and illumination in that issue about the distinction between the legislative intent for separate punishments coupled with if not there and not clear there, then this test under Blockberger, and under Blockberger, I don't think a reasonable argument can be made that double jeopardy exists in the conviction of the counts in this case.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Any questions from the court? Okay, thank you, Mr. Stanton. Ms. Lemke, you have about 7 minutes then for rebuttal.
I always wish I had 30 for rebuttal. Okay. With respect to the contention that Mr. Stanton just made that, that Mr. Reimer is liable here because he knew that his wife was mentally and physically infirm with her myotonic dystrophy and therefore was not capable of caring for the children. Number one, the jury never got to make that determination because, again, they weren't instructed that there had to be that knowledge requirement. Number two, that wasn't the evidence that she was incapable of caring for those children. She had some issues with her hands. Even the officer testified at trial on direct examination when asked by the prosecutors that she was of sound mental condition. The evidence was that she took the child to the doctor on a regular basis, that she was able to care for the children. There was absolutely not one scintilla of evidence presented, despite Mr. Stanton's suggestion to the contrary, that there was something that affected her ability to care for the child, such that Mr. Reimer should have been, as Mr. Stanton said, obligated to go check periodically to see if Jason is doing okay.
Wait a minute. There was other evidence. There was evidence that his feeding tube was inflamed, that he was not cared for adequately medically, that he had the mental competence of a 2-year-old, and then trusting him to the care of Aaron, who also is mentally limited. I think it's an overstatement to say that there was no evidence to suggest it was unreasonable to rely on Colleen to care for this child and without checking in on him.
Well, I understand what Your Honor is saying. That speaks to some of the larger medical issues, and some of the testimony that was disclosed at trial was such that the child's G-tube site would leak from time to time when he would fuss when they were trying to feed him, and there were issues surrounding that. But ultimately, his treating doctors testified that there wasn't any problem, ultimately, of any significance with the G-tube site. You know, now that doesn't mean that from time to time, just like with any other child, they're going to get sick, they're going to have infections, they're going to have issues, and in Jason's case, he obviously had some special needs, but there was no evidence presented by any of the medical professionals who testified, to my recollection, and again, I wasn't trial counsel, that there was some significant problem with the G-tube site. In fact, one of the doctors who treated the child relative to the G-tube site said that it could very easily, when it would get, you know, when there would be issues with leakage, that that could be easily mistaken for necrosis, which is what one of the CPS people wanted to testify to. And he said, no, there wasn't any evidence of necrosis, but I can understand why this granulation, which is a healing process, could be mistaken for that. My point is this. Ultimately, while she might have had some infirmities, they weren't sufficient enough to say that Stan, when he was working or otherwise, shouldn't be able to reasonably rely on her as a caretaker, as he did on this particular day. Mr. Stanton said that the testimony disclosed at trial was that they always went to the bedroom every Sunday and that Jason was always with them. And therefore, he had a duty periodically, and I would love to know, if the statute's not vague, I'd love to know what periodically, as he refers to it, means to go check on the child. If a statute confers on a parent in a two-parent household to periodically go check on his child, which is what Mr. Stanton just suggested to Your Honor, I'd like to see how that statute survives a vagueness challenge, because what on earth does periodically mean? A minute, a day, an hour, every 2 hours? And Mr. Stanton makes the point, well, this is especially true, that is the sequestration in the bedroom, if you will, when Quaylen goes up and knocks on the door, and he suggests to this court that Quaylen was knocking on the door to say, hey, we got a red flag here, Jason's missing. My recollection and my citation brief, and I would urge Your Honors to do your own checking, is that Quaylen testified that sometimes Jason would go upstairs with his parents on Sundays. If he wasn't there, sometimes he'd be playing. And he indicated that he did go upstairs at one point and knock on the door because he wanted to talk about a scouting issue. The suggestion that that Quaylen went upstairs to red flag Mr. Reimer with the door cracked that Jason was missing is not supported by the facts that we just brought out at trial. Thirdly, with respect to the severance of the defendants, Mr. Stanton really quite frankly just made my argument for me. When he said that Mr. Reimer had a duty to care for this child beyond what Colleen was capable of because she had this myotonic dystrophy, that's one of the prejudices, that's one of the reasons that the defendants should have been severed from one another. Because to the extent that Colleen argued in some limited fashion that she was, you know, not always fully capable, as Your Honor suggested, of caring for the child, that would necessarily confer a greater obligation on the part of Mr. Reimer to care for the child. And so there you have those mutually antagonistic defenses, which are impossible for Mr. Reimer to deal with, particularly when his co-defendant's not going to take the stand and testify. Which brings us to her statement, and Mr. Stanton suggested that one of the things that we wanted to get into with respect to her statement was clarifying that she was actually taking responsibility for Jason's death when the police asked her about, well, who was responsible for this happening, and there was an issue, did this happening mean getting him out of the car, or did this happening meaning his death? We wanted to get into that. They initiated the colloquy on direct examination. When we tried to further explore it, they objected speculation and kept it out. But more importantly, what we ultimately also wanted to get into was the fact that Colleen made a wholesale admission of guilt in that statement. Mr. O'Brien, the trial counsel, specifically told the court that he wanted to get out her admission of guilt, a statement against interest, where she said, I am the one who is solely responsible for this happening. And he was precluded from the trial court by the trial court from doing that. That was a critical component of the defense theory, which was that she was solely responsible in light of the fact that he had come home and he had gone to bed. Moving on to the questions about Mr. Stanton about beating, and he kind of, you know, suggested, well, all right, you know, I tried to get them to say this, and yeah, you know, the trial court may have admonished me. Let me tell you exactly how that went down. Question of Quaylen, have there been occasions where your father used to beat you? He gave you spankings. Defense objection. Next question, or maybe a couple questions after I have it as next question. I would like to go back to the questions about each one of the beatings with the paddle or the belt. Another admonition from the trial court to stop. Question,
Can you give me an example of what you would do that would cause your father to beat you with the paddle or belt? Again, objection, sustained. Later, with a defense witness, again, there's a question. When I asked you the question that, the fact that you heard from Stan that he had an order to beat his children, did that cause you concern? Again, another defense objection. I see that my time is running out.
Ms. Lemke, on that beating issue, Mr. Stanton's response was that if it was improper to ask that, which you didn't concede, but if it was, the judge sustained it, and the jury was instructed that questions of counsel are not evidence, so it's something the jury wouldn't have considered the word beating. And what's your response to that?
My response to that is that even though the judge did sustain the objection, I don't recall there could have been an admonition to the jury to disregard. I just don't recall it off the top of my head, so forgive me. I would urge the court to reflect, defer to the pleadings in that regard. However, when a prosecutor is admonished to stop using a verb or a word that doesn't accurately reflect the evidence and does so in a way that is exceedingly prejudicial to the defendant, it becomes misconduct when they do it over and over and over again, over that court's admonition to the contrary. And that ultimately arises to a due process violation and a fair trial right violation, because that repeated use of that terminology over a period of time, whether there's the limiting instruction given or not, is going to infect the jury's deliberations and how they ultimately perceive this evidence. So to that end, ultimately, when you do it again and again and again, there is a constitutional violation that is occasioned.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You know, like that, again, thank you all for your excellent arguments and briefs, and thank you all for some of the younger attorneys coming to observe, and we appreciate that. And again, very excellent veteran of your appellate attorneys here arguing, so I think it's a real opportunity for young attorneys to view these. So thank you for coming. The court case will be taken under submission, and we'll be